WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Al Pacino. He's made a career of playing gangsters and cops, but his new movie, Looking for Richard, is a documentary about performing in Shakespeare's Richard III. We'll talk about directing and starring in the film, and we'll look back on his performance in the Godfather films, which established him as a great actor. Also today, a memoir of a miserable childhood, poor and Catholic in Ireland. We talk with Frank McCourt about his new book, Angela's Ashes, which has become a surprise bestseller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole campaigns in Alabama, Florida, and Louisiana today amid word that the Dole campaign has asked Ross Perot to drop out of the presidential race. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Bob Dole didn't want Ross Perot included in the presidential debates. Now he wants him to pull out of the race completely. The calculation is that Perot's support, no matter how small, could help Dole in close states. But that depends on Perot dropping out and his following shifting their support to Dole. Dole ignored reporters' repeated questions about whether or not he was appealing to Perot. Florida Senator Connie Mack, who's traveling with Dole in Florida, said any time you can pick up a few points here and there, it's worth the effort. Other advisors greeted the news hopefully, saying that even 5% could make the difference in states like Texas or Florida, where Dole and Clinton are dead even. But Perot campaign spokesman Sharon Holman says Perot has no intention of quitting the race. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Pensacola, Florida.
Israelis are commemorating the first anniversary of the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin with ceremonies across the country. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Thousands of Israelis today are lighting candles at the site where 1 year ago, according to the Jewish lunar calendar, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was shot by an extremist religious Jew at a Tel Aviv peace rally. It was Israel's first political assassination and sent shockwaves throughout the country. Israelis today remembered the warrior-turned-statesman who became the first Israeli prime minister to shake hands with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn 3 years ago. Since then, Israelis have lived through suicide bombings, an election that brought hardliner Benjamin Netanyahu to power, and just last month, gun battles between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian police. Israel today seems even more divided than it was a year ago, between those who support the peace process and those who oppose it. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Increased winds in Southern California are threatening to fan wildfires in the region. A cold front is moving through the area now, bringing gusty winds clocked at up to 40 miles per hour. Firefighters are battling blazes that have already scorched 37,000 acres and destroyed more than 100 homes and buildings. 12 people have been hurt, 11 of them firefighters. Two of the victims are in critical condition. Hurricane Lily, which has long left the Bahamas and Cuba, may actually turn into a major problem for Europe. Lily remains a minimal hurricane as it lumbers eastward far out in the Atlantic Ocean. But the National Hurricane Center says Lily could turn into a huge storm as it reaches colder water and moves more to the northeast. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 40 points at 59.96. Trading's moderate. This is NPR. A published report says the families of 12 people used as subjects for government radiation testing may get nearly $5 million and a face-to-face apology. The Miami Herald reports the payment is part of a draft settlement with relatives of the dozen people who were unknowingly subjected to tests in the 1940s. They reportedly were injected with plutonium or uranium while hospitalized in several states. The shots were part of experiments to determine levels for worker safety. The settlement must first be approved by a federal court. French police have arrested 12 people suspected in taking, or rather of taking part, in the bombing of the Bordeaux City Hall earlier this month. Police believe Corsican separatists seeking freedom from French rule were trying to kill Prime Minister Alain Juppé. David Culhane reports from Paris.
French anti-terrorist police units simultaneously raided locations in southern France and in Corsica. The 12 suspects are believed to have helped with the logistics for the bombing, which badly damaged the Bordeaux City Hall. These are the first new arrests since the French government named a special investigating judge to lead an all-out attack against separatist guerrillas of the so-called historic wing of the Corsican National Liberation Front. The Bordeaux bombing was the first time the separatists had launched an assault on mainland targets. Police said they also seized weapons during these latest arrests. Polls show that some 86% of Corsica's 250,000 people are opposed to full independence. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Refugees are fleeing fighting in Central Africa. Relief workers say fighting between Zairean troops and ethnic Tutsis from Rwanda has caused some 300,000 people to flee in eastern Zaire. The UN says this could quickly become a medical emergency. This is NPR.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For the past few years, while Al Pacino has continued to play cops and gangsters in films, he's been obsessed by another project, a movie he not only stars in, but also directed and co-wrote. That film, Looking for Richard, is Pacino's search for the meaning of Shakespeare in our lives today. It combines footage of his production of Richard III with documentary footage of the actors and filmmakers grappling with how to put across Shakespeare for a contemporary audience. Looking for Richard also stars Alec Baldwin, Winona Ryder, Kevin Spacey, and Estelle Parsons. Here's a scene that alternates between the play itself and a behind-the-scenes discussion of the play. Pacino is Richard, scheming to be king. Alec Baldwin plays his unsuspecting younger brother, Clarence.
These, as I learn, and such like toys as these, have moved His Highness to commit me now.
Why, so it is when men are ruled by women. Tis not the king that sends you to the tower, Clarence. Tis my Lady Grey, his wife. Tis she that tempts him to this extremity. We are not safe. Clarence, we are not safe.
Now, if Richard's brother Edward was king, right, and then he dies, Clarence, his other brother, is next in line, right?
No, the kid's were next in line.
And after the king's kids came Clarence.
So Richard figured, let me get rid of Clarence, and then I'll work out how I get rid of the kids.
Meantime, this deep disgrace in brotherhood touches me deeper than you can imagine.
Al Pacino told me that his idea for looking for Richard came out of his experiences in the late 70s touring college campuses. He gave readings of poetry and plays and responded to students' questions.
When I would come to Shakespeare, there was a reluctance. The audience didn't feel comfortable hearing it. They backed off when I even mentioned that I was going to read from it. So I started to give a kind of preamble, like I would just say, you know, there's this guy comes home from school and he finds out his mother, you know, is with the uncle and, oh, man, you know, that kind of thing. And then I'd slowly work my way into the subtext of some of the scenes. And then what would happen is I'd segue into the actual Shakespearean dialogue, and they seemed to be more interested when I did that. So that being done, 15 years later, somebody asked me to do Richard III, and I thought, how would I do as a movie? And I thought, well, how would I do it? And it came back to me, that thing I did in the schools. And so I tried to do that, to kind of merge, to start out that way, merely as an experiment. And then eventually it probably would wind up in the archives, or maybe it would be in eventually find its way into some schools or and then I thought, as we kept doing it, maybe it'd go on television. And then finally, just a year ago, I saw it, a 3.5-hour version of it, and I thought there was a movie in there. I thought there's a film there.
I want to ask you about iambic pentameter. One of the things that's discussed in your movie Looking for Richard is what iambic pentameter is and what it's like for an actor to do lines that are written that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the iamb is the meter. It's what? Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum in its most literal form. And there's 5 ba-dums in each line, which is the pentameter part. So how do you read it without lapsing into this ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum kind of sing-song type of thing?
Well, I think pretty much by trying to communicate what you believe the speech to be saying.
So you don't even think about, oh, this is iambic pentameter.
No, I don't. I don't. I don't not recommend it, because I certainly don't know enough about it to say, but I don't. I know that there's occasionally someone will try to, in certain speeches, explain what the speech means or what they think Shakespeare's getting at here. And if you put a certain accent on a word here, it'll change the whole meaning of the speech. And that happens sometimes, you see. And so it's, that's why you'll find actors will do the same Shakespeare play again and again. I mean, Kenneth Branagh's coming out with a 4.5-hour Hamlet, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he's done Hamlet 5 times.
I'm wondering if you think that there's any connection between Shakespeare and the Godfather films in that. I mean, okay, on the most obvious level, the Shakespearean tragedies and the Godfather films are about men who have risen to power and kill everyone around them and are deformed in some way by their power or by their ambition for power.
I do know that Francis Coppola is an avid Shakespearean devotee. You know, he knows all of Shakespeare and he reads it constantly. And I know he was reading it when he was writing The Godfather 2. And all the Godfathers, he was particularly interested in King Lear. I know he had read Titus Andronicus and of course all the classic Shakespeare plays. So he was involved and immersed in Shakespeare when he was writing Godfather. So maybe some of that rubbed off him.
Interesting. I have a couple of questions about the Godfather films. Really, your performance is just one of the great performances. Your character, Michael Corleone, goes from being, you know, naive, wanting to keep his distance from the family business, but by the end of Godfather 1, he's the new power. I'm wondering how you think your body and your speech changed as the character changed.
I think it was the seeing if that transition was always on my mind. When I first got the role, everything was sort of orchestrated to do that, to make that arc.
to chart that course in the character, because in the end, one wanted to be left with a kind of an enigmatic character,
mm-hmm.
in which you really don't know quite where you stand with a person like that. And I thought that was what Francis and I were trying to say with this character.
Well, do you watch your performances back, and do they read in the way you thought they would?
I don't really watch them. I don't think I saw any of the Godfather. There's a couple of pictures I've done that I've gone and seen some of it.
Wait, you mean you still haven't seen The Godfather?
Oh, no, I've seen it as a whole picture.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't see the
But I haven't seen it in many years.
Right. You'd be the only person in America who hadn't seen it.
No. I've seen it. No. I just didn't go see the Rushes as much. I think I saw... because everything was about that transition.
Right.
And I knew that Francis, who cast me and went to great pains to cast me in the part. I mean, nobody wanted me, and he was really the only reason I got the role, because of his adamant insistence on it. And so I felt that he understood where he wanted to take it.
If nobody wanted you, except for Coppola in that performance, did it make you feel insecure when you got the part?
Oh, yeah. I mean, actors feel insecure anyway when they don't want you for the
right.
role.
Right.
It sort of magnifies it a little. But I felt that it was okay, because, I don't know, I was young, and I really thought, I remember one time saying to Francis, you know, I usually don't like to be around where people don't want me, you know. And he said, well, I said, why don't you get someone else? He said, no. I tell you, I was at that time thinking that it was a real difficult job, and I was a little reluctant myself to do it, because I thought, if this is a problem now and they don't even want me, and it's a tough role anyway, because it's sort of all insular and stuff, and not one that I always thought I should play Sonny when I first read it, you know. I thought that was the role, because it was more showy, more obviously, and it is a terrific role. But I didn't know why what was on his mind when he cast me as Michael Corleone, believe it or not. So it was, then after I saw it, I could see, you know, the reasoning there. I could see it.
Al Pacino is my guest, and he wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Richard III, which is part Shakespearean performance and part documentary about the making of the performance. Now, is it right that you did stand-up early on in your career?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
God, I wish I could have seen some of that. What was your act like?
You didn't want to see that.
Well, what was your act like?
Pretty much like it is now. Not too funny. I would just come up with I had a partner who he and I would come up with these routines. I guess the closest thing would be kind of Saturday Night Live stuff that they do. It was just skits. We even wrote reviews and performed them in the Village in New York City and the cafes, because there was a real cafe world then,
mm-hmm.
with the off Broadway sort of renaissance that happened in the 60s in New York with the playwrights like Sam Shepard and Leonard Melfi and Israel Horovitz and La Mama, if you know of it or you've ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Living Theater, of course, which was the main inspiration for the entire movement.
You really strike me as the kind of actor who hears the music in speech and who hears mm-hmm. the music in the dialogue that you're given. Tell me if
Can
there
I
were...
say something
yeah,
about that, though?
Yeah.
I think that it's a very interesting point you make about music and dialogue, because it's acting's became harder to do when you took the music away from it. You were just left with the lyric, you know, because they were the minstrels that sang and spoke stories while singing them.
Oh, you mean literally the music?
Yeah, literally the music. It's one thing to go, you know, I love you, and it's another thing to go, I love you. I'll do that again someday, but not very soon, let me tell you.
But you do hear the music of normal speech, and I'd have to say a lot of actors don't have that gift. Were you aware of a certain musicality in speech when you were young, before you even started acting? Did you hear that? Did you feel that?
Well, I music was my preference, I guess. So it was my first sort of interest. It's till this day, music is the most of all the art forms. Music is the most relevant to me. I mean, I enjoy that the most.
What kind of music?
All kinds.
What was it?
But yeah, pretty much, I guess, when I was younger, it was classical. But I like all music, rock, rap, anything, folk music. It is mainly classical is what I listen to, but all of it. And so I had at one point a time in my life where I sat down and tried to even compose music. But it's an odd thing because as a youngster when I was in the school, I remember being very nervous at an audition for the Glee Club or something, and I couldn't get the sound of the I think I missed a couple of the chords, whatever it was, and I thought and the teacher they said I had no musical aptitude. So what happened is for years I didn't participate in anything musical. I felt like I was you know, barking up the wrong tree, until later, quite by accident, I fell into music, and that was a real life changer.
What kind of music?
Well, serious music, classical music. I actually was there and witnessed Stravinsky conducting Rite of Spring at Lewison Stadium in Harlem. So it was that experience that you have these epiphanic whatever experiences in your life, and that was one of them. And believe it or not, the other was when I heard once Buddy Rich, the late Buddy Rich, play the drums at Carnegie Hall when he was an opening act for Frank Sinatra. I remember Frank Sinatra coming out afterwards saying, you know, it's amazing when you keep doing something, you know, over and over, the kinds of things that can happen.
Al Pacino. He directed, co-wrote, and stars in the new movie Looking for Richard. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week for public radio. One of the things we're proudest of on Fresh Air is our mix of guests. Today, Al Pacino. Yesterday, Rabbi Vizotsky talking about interpreting the Bible. And coming up, we have Frank McCourt, the author of a best-selling literary memoir about growing up Catholic and poor in Ireland. As you'll hear, he's an incredible storyteller. Our goal is to keep you entertained and informed. Informed not just about the big issues, but about new books, records, and movies you might enjoy. Your station can continue to carry Fresh Air only if you support it with a pledge. Please call now. Thanks. This week, we're featuring a series on the history of the blues with our rock historian, Ed Ward. The recordings he's playing come from two blues boxed sets released by the Smithsonian Institution. Today, we hear about how the blues met the challenge of another new music, rock and roll.
Well, I heard the news. She'll know I'm a mighty, mighty man. I heard the news. There's good to rock it tonight.
The standard explanation says that rock and roll killed blues dead in its tracks, that black teenagers turned toward more modern sounds, and that blues artists played to older and older audiences until the music disappeared. A convenient scenario, but it's not true. For one thing, it ignores the fact that in the mid-50s, American music was still regional, and in the region that was giving us Elvis, the blues was still a vital part of the scene.
Oh.
Junior Parker was one of the Beale Streeters, a sometimes supergroup that played on Memphis Black Main Street, and so was his friendly rival, Bobby Blue Bland. Both men found a way to combine the big band sound of early 50s jump blues with the aggression of a well-played guitar solo into a style that saw their careers last for a couple of decades. Also on Beale Street, another member of the Beale Streeters was making his mark on history.
Thank you so much. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we want to go way back, way back.
Riley King called himself the Blues Boy on his radio show, and as B.B. King, became the most astonishing guitarist Memphis had ever produced. His incredible phrasing and dynamics, along with his uncanny feel for what was contemporary, also kept him on the charts long after blues was having its obituary written. In Chicago, the blues scene met the challenge of rock and roll by getting even more aggressive. Buddy Guy was a young guitarist Muddy Waters had taken under his wing after he'd arrived in Chicago from Louisiana, and he soon hooked up with Junior Wells, who had inherited the harmonica crown after Little Walter's death, a partnership that drew a younger crowd into the clubs. These were the years of the British invasion, and if Muddy Waters wasn't selling as many records as he used to, well, neither was Frank Sinatra. No serious blues observer in Chicago would have called the blues there dead. And in fact, other regions made their contributions during this period. From Crowley, Louisiana, James Moore, known professionally as Slim Harpo, wound up on the pop charts in 1966. Baby Scratch My Back fit right into pop radio's mix, as of course did instrumentals. Texas-born Freddie King made a career out of catchy numbers like Hideaway. So did another Texas player, Albert Collins. By the time Collins recorded Tongue Lashing in 1969, blues was in fact losing its popularity with young blacks. I was derided by some black teenagers in 1965 for my interest in what they called that old Caledonia-fied stuff, and they in turn introduced me to the Temptations. Still, the fact that I was interested in it was a symptom of another chapter in the history of the blues. I'll tell you about it tomorrow.
Rock historian Ed Ward. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the author of the surprise bestseller, Angela's Ashes, a memoir about a miserable childhood, worse than the ordinary miserable childhood, growing up poor and Catholic in Ireland. We talk with Frank McCourt.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Will America Grow Up Before It Grows Old? How the Coming Social Security Crisis Threatens You, Your Family, and Your Country, by Pete Peterson, director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan recently gave a rave review to Frank McCourt's new memoir, Angela's Ashes. Maureen isn't the only one knocked out by the book. It's become a surprise bestseller. So we thought you'd like to hear from Frank McCourt. This is his first book, although he's in his 60s. He spent most of his career teaching writing at Stuyvesant High School in New York. He also toured with his brother Malachy in a musical review they put together about growing up in Ireland. Frank McCourt's new book, Angela's Ashes, is a memoir about his childhood in the slums of Limerick. Let's start with a reading from the opening of the book.
My father and mother should have stayed in New York, where they met and married and where I was born. Instead, they returned to Ireland when I was 4, my brother Malachy 3, the twins Oliver and Eugene, barely 1, and my sister Margaret dead and gone. When I look back on my childhood, I wonder how I survived it all. It was, of course, a miserable childhood. The happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood, and worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood. People everywhere brag and whimper about the woes of their early years, but nothing can compare with the Irish version. The poverty, the shiftless, loquacious, alcoholic father, the pious, defeated mother moaning by the fire, pompous priests, bullying schoolmasters, the English, and the terrible things they did to us for 800 long years. Above all, we were wet. Out in the Atlantic Ocean, great sheets of rain gathered to drift slowly up the River Shannon and settled forever in Limerick. The rain dampened the city from the Feast of the Circumcision to New Year's Eve. It created a cacophony of hacking coughs, bronchial rattles, asthmatic wheezes, consumptive croaks. It turned noses into fountains, lungs into bacterial sponges. It provoked cures galore. To ease the catarrh, you boiled onions in milk blackened with pepper. For the congested passages, you made a paste of boiled flour and nettles, wrapped it in a rag, and slapped it, sizzling, on the chest. From October to April, the walls of Limerick glistened with the damp. Clothes never dried. Tweed and woolen coats housed living things, sometimes sprouted mysterious vegetations. In pubs, steam rose from damp bodies and garments, to be inhaled with cigarette and pipe smoke, laced with the stale fumes of spilled stout and whiskey, and tinged with the odor of piss, wafting in from the outdoor jakes, where many a man puked up his week's wages. The rain drove us into the church, our refuge, our strength, our only dry place. At Mass, benediction, novenas, we huddled in great damp clumps, dozing through priest drone, while steam rose again from our clothes to mingle with the sweetness of incense, flowers, and candles. Limerick gained the reputation for piety, but we knew it was only the rain.
Frank McCourt, thanks for reading that excerpt of your new memoir. And his new memoir is called Angela's Ashes. I want you to describe the house that you grew up in Limerick.
There were a number of houses. When we first arrived in Limerick, it was a one-room affair with most of it taken up with a bed. It was about a half acre of collapsing bed. And then the rest of there was a table. There were two chairs which my mother and father sat on. It was a fireplace, a small fireplace, with two little hobs where you place, on which you placed the kettle. And there was in that particular house, there was a backyard and a lavatory. And we shared the bed with about a million fleas. But then we had to move out of there. One of the twins got sick and died there. So we moved to another place, another room similar to the first one, where another twin died. Oliver and Eugene were their names. Then we finally got out of there, and we went to a house called Roden Lane up in Barrack Hill near the soldiers' barracks. It was a house at the end of a lane. It was called Two Up, Two Down, that kind of house. Two rooms downstairs and two rooms upstairs. Except that these houses had no indoor plumbing and no backyard, so there was one lavatory for the whole lane, about 11 families sharing this one lavatory. And the lane sloped. So when it rained, a lake formed down at the end of the lane, and of course we were down at the end of the lane, and the lake of rain seeped under our door. We tried everything to keep it out. We used rags, everything, sods of grass. But the rain came in, and it was so damp downstairs that we moved upstairs. We called downstairs Ireland, and we moved up to Italy, which was warm upstairs. My mother said, this is like Italy up here, so warm and dry.
Here's a sense memory question. What do you remember the smells of your house as being?
Oh, there was a general smell of dampness. And I don't think we ever noticed that dreadful thing that's so feared in America called body odor, because if we had, we'd all be dead by now. There was none of that. There was the lavatory, when people emptied their buckets. Some families were worse than others. Now I'm going to get very gross and vulgar, but some families were worse than others with those buckets, especially if we had any kind of a warm summer. Then that lavatory was foul. That was the overriding smell all through the house, because we were unfortunate enough to have our front door at a right angle to that lavatory. That was the prevailing smell. And that eventually, I think, is where I got typhoid fever, from that lavatory.
And you spent, about 14 weeks in the hospital with typhoid fever?
Yeah. That was at the onset of my adolescence. And in a way, it was a gift, because I discovered my first lines of Shakespeare, and I discovered the poem The Highwayman, and books in general. I was given access to books.
In the hospital, you were expected to die. The priest came to give you extreme unction. Did you think you were going to die?
I didn't know at the time. I was so sick, I didn't give a damn whether I died or lived or died. I had no idea what was going on. I just knew somehow I was aware of the priest over in the corner saying Mass, And I knew that was significant. Something told me this was significant. And then he came over, and they pulled the sheets down, and they anointed me with the extreme unction oils. So I think I knew enough. We were good at the Catholics. We were well-trained. I knew enough. I think the nurse told me, anyway, that it was going to be anointed.
Well, you were probably used to death. You had already had siblings who had died.
Well, we had people all over. Malachi and I, my brother, we used to go to funerals all the time. We belonged to the Death of the Month Club. A funeral was a great form of entertainment. A wake was a great form of entertainment. We'd wander around the streets. We had nothing else. So we were really street urchins. And we'd wander around the neighborhood looking to see if anybody had died. You could tell by a mourning wreath on the door and which was pinned a purple-lined memorial, purple-bordered memorial card announcing the death and so on, an R.I.P. at the end. And that was the signal for us to knock at the door and say, we were very sorry for your troubles, man, because there was tradition around that if children prayed for the dead, the dead were assured, guaranteed entrance to heaven. So we were guaranteed an entrance to the house to kneel by the bed and say a prayer for the deceased, because they were always kept in the house until they were taken to the church. There was no embalming, no funeral homes. So we'd kneel by the side of the bed, and when we were finished with our little prayers, we could go out to the kitchen and they'd give us lemonade and biscuits or lemonade and buns, and then we were sent home. Unless it was a family we knew, and then we'd stay on for the wake, which went on all night, and then there was Guinness and there was whiskey and there was sherry for the women, and sometimes there was ham and bread. And we'd go around, even though we were only 6 or 7 years old, we'd go around creeping under tables and chairs, emptying the glasses, the jam jars and the cups or whatever was in it, sherry or whiskey or Guinness.
How did all the deaths that you were exposed to and the association between death and free food affect your feelings about death?
Well, we prospered. We didn't mind having somebody die in the neighborhood if it wasn't our own family. But we got excited. We'd go to people's houses and knock on the door. Except one time, one of my friends, a kid named Clement O'Hanlon, died of TB, which we call the consumption. He had been in and out of the sanitarium, and he was a big fat kid who shrank away to nothing and then blew up again. And everybody said, well, that's the end of Clement. You know, when they blow up like that, that's the end. The healthier you look, the closer you were to the grave in our local lore. So when Clement died, he shrank again. And we went to his house, and we went in to pray for him. And Mrs. O'Hanlon, his mother, was weeping and carrying on, she said. And there he was in the bed. He looked all yellow. And he looked like a little monkey. And I was frightened because that was not the Clement I recognized. And she says to me, kiss him, Frankie, kiss him. Kiss your poor little friend Clement. I said, no, Mrs. O'Hanlon, it's all right. Come on, kiss him. And I was very reluctant. So she grabbed me under my shoulders, under the armpits, and pushed me against him and forced me to kiss him. And I'll never, as long as I live, forget the smell of Clement O'Hanlon in the bed, that cold, awful smell, that rot smell of rot that you only get from the dead.
When you discovered books and got deeper into them, I imagine you eventually read James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist.
Yeah.
And there's a scene similar to that in there where he has to kiss the body of his grandmother, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you really relate to that when you read
that? No, I didn't remember. I think I put everything out of my head when I was writing the book. When I read Joyce, I related to all kinds of things, especially the religious stuff, which we all suffer from. There's nothing in the world like being an Irish Catholic. Nothing. I can't. I have Jewish friends who go on about the guilt and all that. They haven't the foggiest notion of what guilt is and fear and the rest of it. Because the difference between Judaism and Catholicism is, in Catholicism we have the grand institution called hell. And if you remember in Portrait of the Artist, hell is described very vividly. I've never come across anything like that in Jewish literature. The walls a million miles thick and the heat a million degrees and so on. And imagine being there a million, million, million years and so on. And devils chasing you with pitchforks ready to ram them up your behind for eternity. Eternity, boys, eternity.
So do you think of your Irish Catholic childhood as being a particularly bad one because your family was so poor, or do you think of yourself as being typical?
Oh, I don't think it was. Well, we were poor, so there was a lot of poverty around. And ours was desperate. I think on the hierarchy of poverty, we were at the absolute bottom. There was the added ingredient of my father's alcoholism, which a lot of the families were poor, but they didn't have the alcohol disease that we suffer from, because he was uncertain. He was a crazy man when he drank. He just drank everything. So we had the Catholicism, the poverty, and my father's alcoholism. We were unique in the annals of poverty.
My guest is Frank McCourt, author of the new memoir, Angela's Ashes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frank McCourt, his new memoir, Angela's Ashes, is about growing up poor and Catholic in Ireland. Your mother used to beg for money, borrow money, get money from charity, and then your father would accuse her of not having pride because she'd beg for money. On the other hand, he'd drink all the money she could have had legitimately. He'd drink that away. What did marriage seem like to you watching your parents?
It didn't seem like much because The marriages, the couples that I knew, the married couples I knew, were always remote from each other, the husband from the wife and so on, because one of the paradoxical things, the stereotype of the Irish that you got, here we are a merry, mercurial, drinking, singing race. The fact is we were a bunch of Paddy Solemns. We were not demonstrative like the Italians. This one race that I always admired when I came to New York, the Italians, for their gusto and their lust for life and the way they demonstrated their affections. Well, we didn't. You were not supposed to show any kind of love. I think it was a kind of weakness. You never saw men embracing each other. You never saw husbands kissing wives. I saw my father kissing my mother when he was leaving to go to England, and I was appalled. I thought it was as if they were copulating right in front of me. Although it was all right to go to the Lyric Cinema. and see Clark Gable kissing people and so on. That was all right, but that's only on the film. And I thought, when I was 9 or 10, they weren't really kissing. What they do was got two films and put them together. They slice it and put them together somehow in the projector so that they weren't really kissing, because people wouldn't do that in public or for a camera.
Gee, it must have been hard for you when you came of age.
You have no idea. My innocence when I came to New York was formidable, epic, that I had to flounder along, because when I became a teacher in New York, I looked at the kids in my classes, high school kids at Stuyvesant High School, with their easy relationship back and forth, comparing myself with them when I was a teenager, and I was a pathetic character.
Well, you got out at the age of 19 in 1949.
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Came to New York. That was the only place. This is where I was born. So I came back here, and I was on a ship, a freighter, called the Irish Oak. They had a small fleet of freighters then, the Irish. And we were supposed to set sail for our first destination was New York. Then they told us 2 days out we were going to Montreal. Then they changed that to New York again. Then they changed it again to Albany. And I was very peeved at that because I wanted to get off in New York City. So we sailed right into New York Harbor on a gorgeous October morning. And there was Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty, and the skyline beyond. And I was in heaven. I had seen the skyline so many times in the movies and in books. I thought I was walking on air. I thought I was... All I had to do now was land in New York City and go dance down Fifth Avenue like Fred Astaire. And Ginger Rogers would be waiting for me in Washington Square. That's all I was going to do for the rest of my life. And music would play everywhere I went.
Well, did you hop off the freighter in Manhattan, even though it was destined
no,
to go
I
to
didn't.
Albany?
Went right up to Albany.
Oh.
They wouldn't let us off.
So the skyline just passed you by.
Skyline passed me by, and we were all angry. But the ship had to dock because of the tide in the middle of the Hudson up near Poughkeepsie. And a man, well, this is in the books, I'm not going to say any more about it. A man came out in a little boat, a putt-putt, and took some of us ashore. We went to a party in Poughkeepsie. And that's that. My first night in America was heavenly. There was a party given by a group, four women whose husbands were away hunting. So they had us, me, and some of the ship's officers, and there was a wild night, thank God.
An antidote to the repression.
Yeah.
You made it to Manhattan, finally.
Finally, I took a train down, and I met a priest on the ship, and he helped me find a room, and he helped me find a job, and I wound up working in a hotel that's famous in American literature, the Biltmore Hotel, where John Cheever often has his characters meet under the clock, or Updike, or J.D. Salinger. There was that large clock then. All the Ivy League types would come into Grand Central on Thursdays, I think, mostly, or Fridays. To have the wild times in New York, you'd have those Harvard boys and Yale boys and girls from Radcliffe and Bryn Mawr and so on. All the golden people, I thought. And I would go around. My job was to clean up in the lobby with a dustpan and a broom and empty the ashtrays and so on. And I moved among them, feeling, feeling humiliated because these were these absolutely beautiful girls whose legs went on forever. And golden hair and so on. They're God's chosen. And I promised myself that someday I'd have one of them. And I did.
And?
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, did you say?
Yeah.
Well, what do you say?
The Chinese said, be careful what you ask for, you might get it.
Right. Frank McCourt is the author of the best-selling memoir, Angela's Ashes. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week, so I'm going to ask you to consider Fresh Air's financial situation. Stations have to pay an acquisition fee for just about every NPR program they carry. The money stations pay to broadcast Fresh Air becomes a major part of our production budget. During this fundraiser, your station needs you to pledge during Fresh Air. If you don't, the station won't be able to pay for Fresh Air, which means you won't be able to hear it. So trust me, there's a direct correlation between your pledge and the future of Fresh Air on this station. Thank you for your support. Back with Frank McCourt, author of the memoir Angela's Ashes, about his childhood in the slums of Ireland. When we left off, he was telling us about coming to New York. Now, how'd you get from doing, you know, sweeping and cleaning jobs in Manhattan to teaching English at Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan?
I owe it all to Mao Zedong.
To who?
Mao Zedong.
Oh, Mao Zedong?
Yeah.
Oh, what did he do for you?
Well, there I was in the Biltmore Hotel... cleaning up and so on, and miserable because I knew I was better than that I could do other jobs, that I could sit in an office or something like that. But I couldn't get anything because I didn't have a high school diploma, the sacred high school diploma. I left school when I was 13. Every time I went for a job, oh, no, you have to have the high school diploma. You have to have evidence that you had a high school diploma. So I waited and waited and waited, and then I toiled away with my broom and my dustpan in the Biltmore Hotel till The Chinese attacked Korea in 1951 or 1950, I think, and America got nervous and turned to me and drafted me. And even though there was a Korean War going on, they sent me to Germany. And I spent 2 years in Germany training German shepherds to be fierce. And then I, when I got out of the army after 2 years, I had a great time in Germany, in Bavaria. There was loads of beer and a surplus of women. So I had a great time. And when I got out of the army, I went to back to the meat. I worked in the docks for a while, and I worked in warehouses, merchants refrigerating and port warehouses and so on, unloading trucks. And after that, then one day I was living in the village in Downing Street, and I used to go to the White Horse bar and sit there in the afternoon before I went to work. I used to work the 4 to 12 shift. And I was having a knockwurst and a beer, and I said to myself, is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life? And I walked out of the White Horse. I didn't know where I was going, but you know the energy you get sometimes when you feel embattled. So I walked out on the sidewalk. I didn't know where I was going. Walked across the village, across Washington Square, and there was NYU. And this is pure serendipity. I walked in, and I looked for the admissions office. I applied. They laughed at the idea of me not having a high school diploma. But I told them I was literate, that I read books and things like that. So they admitted me on a year's probation, mainly because I was a veteran and I had the GI Bill. And I got my B average for a year, and then I was matriculated, and then three more years I was ready to teach high school in the schools of the city.
Are you still teaching high school English?
No, I couldn't. You can't write books and teach high school. It's practically impossible.
When did you retire from teaching?
June of 87.
And did you retire thinking that you were going to write? Was that the reason you did it?
Oh, I always knew I was going to write. This is one of the things that turned me into a schizophrenic practically. I liked the teaching. I loved it. I had some success some days. But I always wanted to write this book. For some reason, I had a responsibility to my family and to the people who lived around me. I felt that I had to convey their dignity of the people, the way they dealt with adversity and poverty and their good humor.
Now, you eventually brought some of your family over to America, didn't you?
They all came.
They all came.
Couldn't keep them away. I sent Maliki came after me. I was in the army when he arrived. Then he joined the Air Force. This was the best time of my mother's life. We were up to send her allotments from the government. So she was able to move to a new house in Limerick. She had clothes and food, two bedrooms and a sitting room and a kitchen and a backyard. So she was doing very nicely. Maliki came, then Mike came, then she came, my mother, with Alfie. So by 1960, we were all here.
How did your mother do in America?
She didn't do very well. I don't think she did. I think she would have been better off staying in Limerick. No matter how bad it is, I thought she was going to come over here and have one big happy family. But we were all getting married, and she didn't particularly care for any of the women that we married, because none of them, and she complained about this, not one of you married a nice Irish Catholic girl. There's nothing in this family but Jews and Protestants, Protestants and Jews. Every time I cross the floor, I'm tripping over little Jews and Protestants. And then the kids would come running to you. Dad, what was Nana doing to me in the middle of the night, pouring water all over my head, baptizing everybody? So I think she was looking for one of us to marry, a nice Irish Catholic girl, somebody that she'd have something in common with, and we never did.
So she was unhappy.
She was unhappy, yeah.
Have you ever gone back to Ireland?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I've gone back a number of times, but always with a chip on my shoulder, a feeling of anger. But I went back in May, and I was back there a few weeks ago with a German television crew, and I felt I got a lot of the stuff out of my system by writing the book, and I feel much more comfortable. As a matter of fact, I'm Ireland. Once you live there, you're seduced by it, by the climate and the weather, the hills, the streams, and everything else. I've always loved it. In addition to that, you have a sense of history. Everywhere you look, something happened there. Something significant happened in Irish history. And then I'm haunted by Limerick, because I go back there and every street corner reminds me of something. Every street reminds me of something.
Frank McCourt, his new memoir is called Angela's Ashes. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tenenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Annie Bacon is our intern. Roberta Sharuk directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.